From the heart of Montana, this is Big Sky, Small World, the Carroll College's student podcast.
Big Sky, Small World, like a mountain high, Montana.
All aboard, choo-choo. Today we got quite a story to tell you all, you listeners of Big Sky Small World. This is the train station workshop, where as a newly hired conductor, I will be guiding a non-stop run through the numerous topics my mind seems to think is so important to fixate on. Today we have our first passenger, who will be introduced. But first, let me glaze up my main man as if he is a devious donut for Krispy Kreme, so that everyone can denote the power difference between us. What could I possibly say about this man that isn't already ingrained in scripture upon the solid molten core within every red dwarf star in our system? What testimony could I give about someone whose deeds of life make up the constellations that future humans will regularly use to guide themselves as they journey across infinite space to new frontiers? I guess one way I could even begin to describe him is to mention that he is an distinguished scholar with a neuroscience degree, a renowned athlete of swimming in Northgate, Seattle, the deadliest three-point shooter to ever exist in pickup basketball at the YMCA in UW, and the author of a book that is already being rumored to have an extended contract for a 50-book series, and the future winner of the Nobel Prize for the next three decades. Without further ado, please let me introduce my good friend, Henry Tan.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me. That was some absolute, what an intro.
Did you like my introduction? Was it adequate enough for you as a distinguished scholar such as you are?
One word would be excessive, but yeah, it was a good one.
Excessive, interesting. Did I miss anything? Should I maybe go back to the notepad?
No, I think we're good.
Okay. Yeah. So let's get to the matter at hand today. We're here because someone in this room, and it's not me, wrote a book. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So where to start? So I guess I'll start with kind of where it is right now as far as the publication process. So it's something I largely started when I was younger. So I think what's interesting about it is I started it sometime in high school. And then eventually it was one of those kind of summer passion projects where you kind of like are really inspired by things you see. It was actually because I'd gone to kind of the Northgate Library where I kind of live multiple times. I was looking for stuff to read and I was like, damn, not a lot of this stuff is kind of what I want. So I kind of wanted to try my hand at making something that I'd really enjoy. So it started out as a summer passion project and then I kind of got dropped and then picked up repeatedly whenever I kind of had the free time. So because it's kind of taken so long and recently, like McLean mentioned, I graduated from university this past June. It's essentially written by multiple people, like different different ages of myself, which, you know, it kind of changed a lot over the years. So there are kind of differences in tone, which are quite interesting that I've kind of had to go back and kind of reconcile with. Yeah, the novel is now complete. It's the title's The Ashes of Eden. I'm kind of currently in the process of pitching it to literary agents. So I want to publish it traditionally. I know nowadays you can self-publish and get a lot of control over stuff like publishing on like Amazon or stuff like that. But I kind of want to go the traditional route. So I'd be pitching it to literary agents with the hope that one would kind of accept it and then pitch it to a publishing house. And then we can sort of negotiate some kind of deal. But yeah, the story is largely about this sort of community living in a sort of very rural and provincial sort of village surrounded by this very mysterious forest. So this is sort of like it is a fantasy novel in a sense. This mystical forest surrounding their village is thought to give things back in a very eerie and uncanny way. So this is sort of a society where mothers that have deformed infants or infants with birth defects will essentially leave their children in the forest and then expect their bellies to fill again because the forest gives back. So essentially, the story mainly revolves around one household. It is composed of a father named Doran and his daughter Eleanor. This family is kind of been, it's missing one essentially, Eleanor's mom. So Doran and his wife, Ophelia, were essentially adventurers and part of a group of people in the village that really wanted to explore the forest and chart its bounds and see what's really out there. And then one day, Doran's wife left and never came back. So after she left, essentially, or disappeared, with her was his sense of adventure. He became this very kind of cynical social pariah in the village that instead of really worshiping this forest, which they kind of treated as a receptacle, he kind of resented the name of adventure and really tried to squash whatever sense of wonder it had for his daughter. So as a social pariah who doesn't really appreciate the forest, he is also a hunter by trade. And one day he comes across a child he finds in this forest. And then the question is, oh, 13 leagues, sort of like the equivalent to miles in this fantasy setting. When you find a child that far in the forest, their parents must have surely sort of abandoned them there. So he comes to this sort of critical moment where he realizes the traditions of this village are really quite cruel, and he decides to take the boy in and raise him as his own. So that's kind of where the story starts. There's this family of three: Doran, Eleanor, and then Fable. And then essentially, the big difference between Fable and Eleanor is Fable has these sort of unknown sort of origins. Well, he's thought to essentially belong to the village somewhere, so he is a very introvert in a sense. He adopts Doran's trade and becomes a hunter, but he spends most of his time in the forest, and he doesn't like to venture towards civilization in the village because he thinks, his parents are in there somewhere, and he's kind of radicalized and paranoid that by living, he's essentially deprived his parents of a son, like a new son that they wanted. In the converse, Eleanor is really quite adventurous, and her father's attempts to kind of squash this sense of wonder in the forest is lost on her. And because she's so willing to sort of wander off and leave and so kind of wild, her father essentially bans her from entering these woods. So the story really has that kind of traditional fantasy elements where, there's some establishment of an original kind of ordinary world and then the call to adventure. So in this case, and that's called the monomyth, if you haven't heard it before. It's essentially this formula that a lot of people think every good story has. So I kind of unintentionally, obviously, I'd just written stuff based on what I'd kind of seen and liked and ended up subscribing this sort of formula. A lot of Disney shows actually follow. It's kind of interesting. You can always like break it down into these several main kind of components. But yeah, this call to adventure and the story begins when there is essentially a festival or a tradition called the Harrowold. And it's a tradition where people go into the forest and essentially try and go farther than they did last time and kind of explore the woods. So they'll mark trees and whatnot and essentially leave the safety of the village. The forest is composed of two parts, essentially. There's the shallow woods where trees are kind of normal as you'd expect, except trees in this kind of fantasy setting in this village are all completely gray. And then bordering the true unknown are these humongous trees called like heathen woods. So these humongous trees that are kind of inspired by sort of redwood forest up here in the Pacific Northwest. But essentially, a mysterious disease kind of ravages their farms and stuff like that. So this herald this year where people are sent out, Doran sees it as a partly described sort of human sacrifice for, for the forest to give back and restore their fields. And it turn just so happens that Eleanor wants to leave on this expedition and takes Fable with her. So that's kind of how the story begins.
Wow, well spoken, I might say. I
A little bit of a rant, yeah.
that's all right. When you mentioned about how this book was written by different perspectives of yourself, you would put it down, you would live your life a little bit, and you would pick it back up. What I'm wondering here is, from that maturity you gained over the years of writing this book, is that reflective in the story itself? You kind of mature the characters along the different stages as they come into contact with new obstacles, new challenges that they must overcome.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it would be cool if that was the case. I hope it is. So essentially, when I first wrote the book, I felt like a lot of the plot and characters were quite subscribed really to specific tropes. And then as I kind of grew up and changed and matured a bit here and there, hopefully, a lot of the characters adopted their own, more of their own sort of individual personalities. I very much feel like it's hard to write something and be an author without sort of inserting yourself in there. And in this case, I think it manifests in me kind of splitting myself up into kind of multiple different kind of feelings or personalities in a sense. Like Fable kind of represents the more, so Fable is the boy that was kind of discovered in the woods and taken under by the family, the Dagonhearts, Doran and Elinor. And he's definitely kind of represents this more introspective kind of, I don't want to say antisocial, but yeah, introspective and introverted kind of side of me. And then Elinor comes out and manifests in the more sort of extroverted, kind of courageous part, I'd say. So I think, and yeah, Doran's kind of modeled actually after my own sort of my mother actually, who kind of brought me up as a single parent. So it was kind of like it just made more sense to write it that way.
Well, let me just say that when I read this book, and I kid you not, I could not put it down. I mean, it took me about maybe 3 days. I mean, he shipped this book to me express. You know, he's got the signature, nice little special note he wrote to me about how I'm getting 50% of all profits from the future sales. But that's that can be discussed later. But let me just say, when I put that last page down, I thought about this book for 2 weeks straight. I mean, I dreamed about it. I dreamed about all of it. And let me just say, you know, a book hasn't really captured my attention such as this. And you're on the right track. As you said, you're still working through it. And I think that, you know, a little bit of time, because now you're finished your degree, now you got your job going, and you're doing wonderful stuff in that field. And this is almost as if it's an outlet for your real life. That, I mean, that's how I read it. I've known you for maybe 10 plus years now, I think.
Yeah, it's been a while.
I mean, we knew each other briefly in middle school, but you were on the opposing basketball team, so we didn't really talk. But I would just say I can see the different stages, and I'm not saying these characters are just you. I can see a part of yourself in the character because, like all good writers, they leave a part of themselves in their work. And I think you're doing that. And I think, you know, maybe just a little bit more time, a little more focus, which you can have. You have all the time in the world. I think this is a can be a phenomenal book. And that's coming from a bookworm who just reads nonstop nowadays. I wake up,
I
I go to
appreciate it.
school, I
Yeah.
read, and then I go to bed. So,
Appreciate it. Appreciate
I briefly want to talk about the title. The
it.
title is Ashes
Yeah,
of
really
Eden.
quickly, this guy's being so humble. He thought about this book for 2 weeks and he sent me a huge, huge list of very helpful improvements. So
Well, you know,
really
I couldn't
appreciate
help
it.
it, but
Yeah. A lot of which have been integrated already. So I'm very
Ooh.
excited for you to get that reprint and get your new thoughts on it. So
So if any of you ever do read the book and you hear about a troll living under the bridge with warts on its face, know that that is a caricature of me. That's my character I've written in. And all I demand is
oh
that
no.
someone give me their left shoe so they could cross because the creature is made up of 1,000 left foots. No, I'm just kidding. I'm messing with you.
That's pretty good.
So the title is Ashes of Eden. And the imagery that is at play here is so vivid. You come up with that name, Ashes of Eden, because let me just say, when I think of that, I think of destruction, but I also think of rebirth.
Oh, no, that's a really good question. So essentially, some of the elements of the plot, the later kind of larger epic fantasy elements of the plot were actually derived from the very last chapter of the Bible. That chapter is called Revelation. What's interesting about it is it essentially depicts the biblical end of the world. Furthermore, a lot of the events in Revelations, like, I mean, scholars have tried to analyze it and things like that, but a lot of it's heavily figurative. For example, there's dragons with like seven heads and 40 crowns and kind of odd features like that that are deeply sort of symbolic and metaphorical. I remember reading something about different heads representing nations and things like that. A lot of the epic fantasy plot of this novel, some of it's derived from these little, taken literally, these kind of fantastical elements of Revelations. So already there was this sort of biblical sort of connection to the novel. And then essentially the work kind of culminates in, I mean, it really largely revolves around these two, I mean, Elinor and Fable kind of being young adults and adventuring into this unknown. So themes around like the loss of innocence are really poignant, I think, in the novel. And to me, you know, Eden, essentially the biblical Eden when Adam and Eve kind of left the garden, it kind of represents like paradise in a sense. Eden was essentially a paradise and to me it was almost like a metaphor for innocence, really. So the Ashes of Eden is literally a play on this kind of loss of innocence and kind of stepping out of paradise into the unknown.
Wow. Well put and said. I mean, I don't know. Maybe this is about 2 weeks ago. I was standing in my doorway and I saw the name of your book. And then I sent Henry like a 3-page long poem about the ashes of Eden in relation to his story. So Amen. That's why I asked it, because I was just so, it's such a good title. It really is.
Yeah. It's a very good thing you sent over as well.
Well, thank you. And here I am fishing for more compliments from my guest.
No. Well deserved.
I guess I have one more question. I mean, you already mentioned about like the moral takeaway of this story of kind of a loss of innocence and coming to the world as a new
as new characters, like growing up in maturity and essentially, man.
So I guess the only real question I have left is, we kind of touched on this a little bit, but you mentioned writer's block. I know a lot of different writers have a different strategy to conflict that, but what is your kind of key takeaway to kind of overcome this writer block that so many people suffer from?
Well, that's a really good question, because I feel like ultimately many people struggle with it, but it's really a, I don't know if I have a for surefire way to kind of solve it, because it's very much something I deal with as well. Generally, I think what I've tried to do is think about what I've written for a long time. I remember reading something about authors who kind of write something and then they'll actually wait a really long time before going back and reading it, essentially because it gives them that sort of fresh eyes to analyze things very critically. For me, I feel like I'm constantly thinking about, oh shoot, I need to be wrapping this up. I need to be wrapping this up. And then kind of just getting stuck with other tasks and essentially just life, really. For me, the best way to overcome it is kind of by reading bits that I enjoyed really writing, or actually just, I mean, the hard part is sitting down and really finding time to just write, like not really caring about what you're writing, but just getting the courage to kind of sit down, force yourself to kind of just wrestle with it. I think really that's the best, pretty much the only way to really figure it out. Just like no expectations, just carve out some time in your day to really sit down and get to it. Yeah, the hardest part for me has been the timing really.
Because you're a busy guy. I mean, we grew up together. I know how busy you are. You're a hard worker. You strive in all fields you can undertake for your family, for yourself, and for your friends. And it's very honorable, I would have to say on that.
Appreciate it. You too, too kind of you.
Well, you know, this whole segment is just glazing. No, I'm just kidding.
I wasn't sure if I could say that. I was going to be like, realize.
I'm trying to get my friends to join me. So you're like the first fish. It's a big fish. Don't get me wrong. This is a behemoth. It's a 15-pounder. Pull it off the docks. Take a photo with it right next to my body so you know how big it is. I'm not putting it in front of the camera to make it look bigger. So then when I let you go, you swim to the other fishes in the pond. And you're like, yo, this guy, he's pretty cool.
Oh, sure. This is very, very, I'm very impressed. This is very well.
And then
organized.
You get Ian and Alejandro to contact me. Now, I understand that this is not the finalized version. And that you have corrections you have added, because again, this is basically version zero per se, and you're probably on version two or three. But I was wondering if it would be possible if I could read a chapter, one of your choosing, aloud to the listener so they can see how special this book is, even in its early stages.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I think so regarding the changes essentially I've made, a lot of stories today actually start with this in media res, I think, which is Latin for starting in the middle. So today we kind of have this, at least the industry seems to kind of be moving quite quickly as far as advancing the plot. So in media res really means thrusting the reader into some kind of conflict while you're in the middle. And then they're kind of picking up the pieces and figuring things out as they go. So my story very much doesn't subscribe to that kind of method and starts really at the beginning. So this restructuring I've been doing is trying to kind of get the plot moving a little quicker, just for so people don't put it down as quickly, essentially. So I made a lot of sort of revisions, I think, to chapter one and how the story starts, just to get it moving a little quicker. But I'd be very happy if McLean could read chapter two instead, which is kind of a shorter vignette. Is it titled Gentle Hunter, chapter two?
Yes, it is.
Okay, there we go.
Chapter 2, Gentle Hunter. It grows too warm in the middle of the day, Dorian said. The animals know this. They bask in the shade of the deep forest. In early morning, they creep up from the hearthwoods closer to the warm fields. Okay, you may hear the same ground many times, but you must be patient. Keep your eyes open. Never go too far, and always remember where you come from. Fable nodded at Dorian's words and tiptoed despite his wild excitement. An earthly Pritikor permitted the forest floor with a recent rain, and a nippy breeze gossiped through the gray leaves. Together they flitted like birds past the trees and leapt over open patches of bearded irises and black wool wood sorin. Then Dorian motioned to slow down. He began to pace ahead with the hunter's gait, pausing his steps here and there to scrutinize the earth for any tracks of the four shy black elk. When Dorian turned his head, Fable stopped to pluck a few flowers and shyly stuffed them into his pocket for Eleanor. Dorian hardly ever let her into the woods. Dorian secretly took notice of his actions, but didn't stop him until he scooped beside a rare bed of midnight ruffles hellebores, packed secretively into a crevice between fallen logs. Fable's eyes traveled up and down their crisp black leaves and white golden anthers with awe-parted lips. Before he could pick some, Dorian cleared his throat. Fable snatched his hand back, just looking. They're poisonous. Oh, they were her favorite, Dorian said, so quiet that Fable didn't hear him. Dorian traversed the woodlands with a large span to test Fable's mettle, but Fable followed closely behind. The boy watched the ground carefully and eventually found the subtle imprint of hooves in the soil. He quickly tugged at Dorian's sleeve, and the hunter turned to analyze his pupil's findings. Good. Fresh. They followed them endlessly. At once, Dorian stilled, turned, and brought a finger to his smiling lips. Together, they crouched beneath the veil of the underbrush and just beyond, where a bar of honeyed light pierced the gray canopy high above. A pearly white stag, opalescent in the half-light, nipped at a ruddy hawthorn. The sight of it made Fable's heart flutter with wonder. It would fetch an entire bucket of silver buttons if we could lug it to Levian, Dorian muttered in his ears. The honor is yours. Fable's features hardened. Quickly, he notched an arrow from his quiver and drew the bowstring to his ear. He stared hard at the stag, its antlers like a crown of ivory and its lambent skin otherworldly. His arm shook as he took deadly aim. Dorian gave him a firm, reassuring squeeze on the shoulders. Fable stood that way for three sharp breaths. He chewed his lip, and some hidden nerve made his body tremble. In one motion, he loosed an arrow, and the entire world stilled as it fired away. The arrow flew, straight and true, and vanished into the woods to the left of the stag. The creature stiffened and darted off into the trees. Dorian sighed loudly. Fable lowered the bow and turned towards them with an expression of shame and dread. Dorian was breathless, gaze frozen at the hearthbone bush where the stag had stood. You held the bow too long. Fable looked close to tears. You can't notch the arrow too early. You aren't strong enough yet to hold it too long yet. Dorian shouldered the bow. Let's go home. The track back to the cottage was very quiet, and Fable didn't stop to pick any more flowers. Instead, he wrestled with an uncomfortable feeling gathering in the pit of his stomach, an ache that each time Dorian waved off of his instant apologies or each time Dorian's eyes became distant and his fists tightened over the limb of his bow. Fable had no doubt he was returning to that moment and taking the shot himself. Disappointment and hunger were given a few hours to fester, and by the time their trek was over, Fable was nearly crippled by the weight of his choice. Once they returned home, Fable went to relieve Eleanor from watering the crops. Despite her questions, he absolutely refused to spell how the hunt had gone, so she went to ask Dorian. She found him sitting at the dinner table, with his chin nestled in his arm and his mouth a hard line. He vaguely muttered a greeting to her and resumed staring into space. Yet beneath the table, his foot quietly tapped the ground. All this would mean nothing to a normal person, though Eleanor rarely saw him so agitated. When it became apparent that she wasn't leaving, he finally looked at her.
Was he that bad? She asked quietly.
For a moment, Dorian said nothing.
Well?
No, he replied. He didn't scare away all the animals like he did when I first took you into the woods. He didn't hum. He didn't wave his bow around. Didn't try to wander off.
He bottled his curiosity in there. Why are you so angry? Eleanor looked at him expectantly.
I'm not angry.
Yes, you are.
Dorian sighed. It's because he did everything right. Dorian's foot stopped tapping. He was unwavering, quiet, attentive, patient, and lucky too.
You found something.
We found a starlight stag, the first I've seen since I was a young hunter with Flyerbeck and his brothers when we were young men. No one in Leyvin would have believed me if we hadn't been there. And still, five capable hunters, 500 paces away, it caught our scent downwind and scared off. Dorian rose and began pacing across the room. This one was in plain view. Fable couldn't have hoped for a better shot. It stood as though it had watched him, its bare neck in plain view, daring him to fire away. It would have been a legendary first hunt when my own heart was beating furiously in joy for him. It would be the talk of the village.
What happened? Eleanor demanded, planting her hands firmly on the table.
He missed.
Oh.
On purpose.
What? Eleanor cried with renewed vigor.
He looked at the stag for a moment as though conspiring with it and very subtly adjusted his aim to the left into the bushes.
Eleanor laughed. He couldn't find it within himself to kill it.
Dorian gave her a look. Just because you don't have these inhibitions doesn't mean I'm taking you into the woods anytime soon. You'll wander off as soon as I turn my back.
Eleanor wilted.
There was a brief pause in, and the mood in the air sobered. How strange, Eleanor. A natural hunter that won't kill.
A hunter with a heart of gold.
She corrected inwardly, brushing her hair behind one ear.
Oh, it's quite poetic, isn't it? She said instead, sneaking a hand thoughtfully into her pocket, which was filled with Fable's wildflowers. She didn't say anything else about Doran's disdain, or Fable being the reason why they didn't have any meat that week, though some secret part of her was very happy with it.
Wow, Chapter 2, The Gentle Hunter, The Ashes of Eden. What a great story. If you have any more questions about this book, feel free to virtually stalk Henry Tan on all social media so that he will feel pressured to vote, because as we discussed earlier, pressure is one of his main writer blocks. So the more pressure he has, the more likely he'll have writer's block, the more likely he'll get it done. Of course, that is me being satire. Many people don't understand that, but, you know, we'll work from there. Thank you, Henry Tan, for this little interview on the book Ashes of Eden.
Dude, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Big Sky, Small World is sponsored by the Carroll College Communication Center.
Helping the Carroll and Helena communities with presentations, multimedia, and podcasting since 2020.
Find us in the library or email Director Alan Hansen at ahansen@carroll.edu.
This has been Victoria Abel with Big Sky Small World Student Podcast. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Paxton Shepherd. I'm a junior here at Carroll College. I'm a political science major. I'd like to go to law school. That's my goal.
Oh, cool.
But for the esports team, I'm the manager for the team. So if you've seen anything about the team, whether that's advertising, our Instagram page, our Twitch posters, that's all kind of what I do for the team. And then our other manager, his name is Steven Sanders. He is the more like coach and strategist and the one who deals with all the competition stuff. And I also play on the team.
Okay, so, that's cool. Yeah. So you handle more of like the media side of the team?
Yeah, that's why I'm the one on the podcast, not Steven.
Okay, very cool. Well, I guess that answers my first question then. For the record, can you state which game your team currently plays competitively?
So right now, I play on the Overwatch team and I play on the chess team.
Okay.
In the past, we've had tons of different teams. We've had like League of Legends and Rocket League, pretty much any esport game that you can think of out there. We've had a team in the past, but we are open to be playing anything. It just depends on what people want to play there on the team.
Okay. How did you get introduced to Overwatch and chess, I suppose?
Actually, chess is a little different. I've been playing chess since I was like very, very young. Mm-hmm. And chess has a huge esports scene. So when I joined the esports team, I was like, man, we got to start playing chess. But Overwatch, I was actually introduced to it through the team when I was a freshman. My first semester at Carroll, somebody named Brady, who was like, he was a senior and he kind of took me under his wing a little bit. He invited me to come play down in the esports room and just try it out. And I'd never touched Overwatch in my life. And I was so awful at it. It was horrible. But from then on, I joined the team and they worked with me and they coached me up, and now I'm an adequate player at least with, I play a good role on the team now and the team's successful. We win games. So Overwatch has been a bit of a journey here, but especially through the teaching of Steven, he's 1 year above me. So
okay.
He was already the coach as a sophomore when I joined, just because he's very, very good. And he's really helped me develop into a strong player.
Okay. Wow. That's really cool.
Yeah.
What's your favorite part of being a member of the team?
That's hard. being a member is a lot of work, but I feel like it's rewarding because it is fun just to kind of hang out with my friends. Like, I'm friends with the esports team players. I like them. You know, we get to practice, and our practices are just like seriously playing a game that we enjoy playing with people we enjoy to be like being around. But for a best moment, it's got to be when we win games. It's just like the whole night is amazing because after we win a game, everybody, you know, like stands up from the computers and we're all being like this big hoorah moment and it's super exciting and it's fun. And the streamers are talking about our cool win and we get to all watch the stream back together and see what the commentators said about it during the game. So those are probably the best moments. The wins make it all like all the actual like annoying grindy like work and practicing, it makes it all worth it.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. I haven't played I haven't been involved in esports at all, but I have been involved in like volleyball and basketball. And it's kind of after the winning that big game, you just, you know, it pumps you right up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, like I've played sports in the past. I get that some people might think like esports, you guys aren't even putting in work. You're just sitting out there playing video games. But I mean, we do a lot of like studying beyond just like sitting down and playing the game. Like we study the metas in mm-hmm. games and we talk about strategy with each other. And one of the things that Steven really likes that the team maybe doesn't like as much is we do something called a VOD review, where we watch the replays of people's point of views in games. Mm. And Steven just like obliterates us for every error we've ever made. Like if we think the wrong thing during it, he'll be like just getting honest about it. So we put in a lot of time to get our minds right and to get our strategy right and to really fine tune how we play. So yeah, when we win, we get like that kind of similar to a sports mm-hmm. feeling where it's like, yeah, it was all worth it. This is, you know, it's very exciting.
That critiquing method, does that help like benefit you in practicing, kind of pointing out where you need work the most? Or can it what's the right word? Can it kind of break down the motivation to play?
Yeah, I think so. I think the critiquing method is sometimes difficult for us because Steven really lets us have it. Especially the our top team, mm-hmm. We try to with new players just to like get them involved and build up the fundamental skills. And so, you know, telling somebody to not do like this very basic thing, it's a lot easier just to be like, hey, here's this basic thing that you probably didn't know about yet. Let mm-hmm. us like walk you through and kind of talk to you how to play. It's like, I guess like in football, like if there's somebody staring at you and they're standing right where you're going to throw the ball, don't throw the ball there. but for our higher team, it's a lot more specific. And the game that I play, which is Overwatch, mm-hmm. there's so much stuff going on and so many things that you have to be managing at the same time that you're at any moment making like 5 or 6 decisions all at the same time. And Steven is so good at breaking down all of those decisions and being like, okay, you may have made these 4 right, but why are you, instead of walking to the left right now so that you're prepared for the next 30 seconds, why aren't you walking to the right and doing like this very specific different thing? Or, like you should have reacted, you know, half a second sooner to this thing that the opponent did mm-hmm. so that we could respond better, because 15 seconds later, because you responded late to that, we lose this fight or we, you know, are in a bad position. So yeah, definitely the VOD reviews are good because there's a lot of fine tuning when it comes to esports. It's really all games are won and lost in the margins. Mm-hmm. You don't lose because you're just like making these very obvious mistakes. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How important is communication during like gameplay, and how does your team kind of train in this area, just communicating back and forth?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's a very, very good question. I feel like esports is one where communication is very, very prominent. Like in other sports, people talk, you know, and you mm-hmm. like your quarterback is doing audibles or baseball players are talking about outs or something, you know, or whatever's going on. But in esports, we're communicating the entire game. Like there is never a down moment where our comms or like our voice channel that we're all in is not saying something. And that's something that we actually have to train a lot, because there are certain things that you shouldn't be saying because they're not valuable enough to be clogging up like the communications. Mm-hmm. And there are certain things that you have to be saying. So everybody during the game is talking and saying something, and everybody actually has different things that they're supposed to be saying. So Steven is our tank player, which means he plays way up in front, and he is making call outs or talking about what's the other team doing. He's tracking their abilities that they've used or their ultimates they have, the positioning they're in. Me and Camille, who is the other damage player, we're making kind of the middle call outs. So we're talking about, okay, who should we single out? Who should we like rotate for? Do we need extra help because we're going to go make like an aggressive play? And the people in the very back, they're making all of our like big picture defensive callouts, which is our support players. So mm-hmm. if somebody's flanking around to the left, they've got to listen to their headphones and tell everybody like, to the left, we have this character, or this person's flanking to the right, or watch out for this push that's going to happen. So everybody is conveying information literally the entire game. Like, there is never a down moment, which it is very difficult to train that, because sometimes people are saying things they don't need to be saying or aren't saying the right things. So last season, one of our big focuses was communication. Mm-hmm. And our first game last week, our communication was spot on. And it really translates. Like, you can see that last season we were struggling in a lot of our games. We're having a lot of close finishes. We weren't ever really like taking charge of matches. This season we are communicating strongly, and it's just, we're unbeatable when it comes to that part of the game. Like, people can't penetrate our back line because we're just communicating so well.
Thank you. That's really good. Yeah. So I'm really happy to hear that. I was just about to ask about how well the game went last Wednesday.
Yeah, it went very, very, very well.
Good.
It was very clean. And I think that is the biggest thing, because our team, so this is our fourth season competing for Overwatch, and mm-hmm. our team has like this weird theme where we're just very like scrappy. Like, we don't win games cleanly, but we're a good team because we can scrap better than other people. So when everything kind of falls apart, we are just a team that can make like the big moment consistently in these fights and turn it around. But that's not a very consistent winning strategy. Like, we win games and we do well just because we can like kind of scrape by. We can like just get there. But this game was different, where instead of playing that kind of scrappy style, we just came out and we were like, okay, we're going to take charge from the very first moment. And we took charge and we didn't make dumb errors. We kept it very clean and we just coasted to a win just on, you know, not making errors, like I said. So it's this year's been a very good feeling of not having to be the like underdog scrappy team that's always coming back.
Right.
We were the one that got to set the tone. So and we're hoping tonight is no different. We're hoping we can keep that going.
Yeah. When is the game tonight?
Tonight it will be at 7 p.m. Mountain Time. There is a live stream that is in Simperman Hall Auditorium every Wednesday at 7. So if anybody wants to come watch the game live, or you can follow us at Twitch at @CCEsports_. That's our Twitch channel. There's also a YouTube channel that we live stream the games on starting this week. Last week we didn't live stream it because we were just focused on the Twitch. And that is @Carol_Esports. And you can also find like anything information-wise about the team just on our Instagram, which... I know the main Carol Instagram will like post stories about us on there. So you could mm-hmm. catch us on there, but if you want to just find us directly, it's @Carol_Esports.
All right. Very cool. Do you have a good feeling about this season then?
Yeah, we are very excited. The team, like, if you had to set a like under over, like a betting odds thing for the team winning a championship this year and just going all the way through 10-0, man, I don't know. I think most people on the team would probably bet for that we're going to go get 10 wins, that we're going to get through this regular season undefeated. Maybe, I mean, like, the only game that we're thinking could be one of those games that we could lose and play well and, you know, put up a good fight, but maybe just get bested, would be against Pittsburgh State. We play them week 5, and they're a solid team. They're a team that we've kind of just got to see how they play the rest of the season to prepare for them. But if we can get through them, we're expecting to kind of clean up this regular season. We're the strongest team in our league. It's pretty clear. As long as we're playing clean, we're going to get there. And then once the playoffs come around, you never know. You know, the playoffs is like any sport or like any game. You never know what can happen on any given day in the playoffs. But we're expecting to, you know, have a good run in the playoffs. Hopefully the strongest team really that we could face this season would be LSU. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're probably going to have to play them in the playoffs to get a championship. So that's the game that we're looking forward to, but we're trying not to overlook the rest of the season. So high expectations.
All right.
Yeah. In April, we could be playing a championship game.
Wow. 100%. Okay.
Yeah, 100%.
I really wish you guys luck with that. It sounds really exciting. Yeah. So high hopes. Great. For you personally, you said you wanted to go to law school after Carol. Do you want to, let's say, you know, all of the esports thing works out and you just absolutely fall in love with it. Do you want to pursue a career in esports, whether it be management or playing?
I'm probably not good enough to ever play professionally. I feel like I'm not too bad. Like, at a college level, I can have fun and compete. But yeah, those professional players get crazy. Like,
they
at
do.
The world stage, it's like, whoa, those players are very, very, very strong. But yeah, I would totally be interested in jumping into the scene. I think esports is kind of, it's kind of like a fringe thing right now, but it's becoming really popular. And I mean, a lot of people I feel like don't even recognize that esports is becoming such a big thing. When you look at the college league that we play in, there's, I think, 450 colleges just our, like, under the organizer. So there's a lot of excitement around esports, especially at the college level. And then professionally, there's tons of, you know, global esports leagues. Mm-hmm. So if I ever had an opportunity to come back to esports, whether, you know, practicing law or doing something for some team, I would totally be interested. I think esports is so cool and is on the precipice of a absolute explosion in popularity globally. And in our marketing, we reach out to a lot of high school students. And the excitement that's getting me to think that esports is about to blow up is the amount of high schools that now have esports programs. And you've got 14-year-olds that are starting to play. By the time they get to college, they're like 4-year actual competitive players. They're coming into esports actually like as esports players. They're not, they're getting recruited. So yeah, I would absolutely be into doing anything esports related.
All right. Well, that's all right. Thank you. I believe that's all of the questions I have for now. Is there anything else you want to say before we hop off?
I guess just if anybody's out there and they're wanting to come play with us or, you know, come join the esports team, totally feel free. Like you can either come reach me out or reach out to me on like my Carol email. It's just P Shepherd. You can come stop by at the room. The room is almost always open. You can hit us up on Instagram or, you know, on Twitch DMs, however you want to reach us. We're easy to find if you want to come play. And any game that's competitive that you'd like to start a team for or go compete on, we will fully sponsor you. We give you all your equipment, any registration stuff. The only thing that you have to do is show up, practice, and play. And we're going to take care of all the logistics for you. And you can really come start a team for anything. So don't be a stranger and feel free. And make sure to catch our streams at 7 p.m. on Wednesdays because this is going to be an exciting year and you don't want to miss it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for giving me your time to interview. Hope you all are having a great day.
Thank you for tuning in to Big Sky, Small World. The music is by Alex Coulter. Please follow and leave comments on Instagram at bigsky.smallworld. Tune in next week.